Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with the great food writer Jessica Harris, author of High on the Hog, Beyond Gumbo, and so many other great books. We'll be talking about her new, very personal memoir, My Soul Looks Back. Nicholas Reynolds talks about his book, Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures, 1935 to 1961, and Phyllis Jordan previews that annual Rite of Spring, the Symphony Book Fair. I am so pleased to welcome Jessica Harris, the author of 12 cookbooks documenting the food and foodways of the African diaspora, including her most recent award-winning High on the Hog, a culinary journey from Africa to America. Jessica was the first scholar to hold the Ray Charles Chair in African American Material Culture at Dillard University, and she's been a professor of English at Queens College for more than 40 years. So, of course, she lives the bicoastal life, dividing her time between New York, New Orleans, and Martha's Vineyard. Today, we're talking about food and life. Jessica Harris chronicles both in her gorgeous new memoir, My Soul Looks Back. Jessica Harris, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much. I love the title, The Reading Life. Lord knows that's mine.
No, mine too. I can tell it's yours. Now, what a life you've lived. I hope this is just the first of many memoirs.
But... Oh, bless you for that. Not that God's here, yeah.
Oh, but this is the part of your life story set in mostly in New York in the 1970s, and it's framed by your relationship with an important man in your life, Sam Floyd. I hope you'll tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Sam was, he taught here. He was amazing. He was an incredible intellect. He was a writer. But I guess in the context of the story, the thing that was astonishing was that he lived in the same apartment building as James Baldwin in New York's Greenwich Village at some point, and he became Baldwin's best friend. And through Sam, I met all of these extraordinary people who changed our world.
It was such a creative circle of friends besides Baldwin, Maya Angelou, Nina Simone, Toni Morrison. You didn't have the best first meeting with Nina Simone, did you?
No, I didn't. But you know what? Age has mellowed all of that.
Well, tell us about that very first moment and what she said to you.
It wasn't to me. It was just to space, if you will, or to the assembled masses, and I was unknown to most of them at that point. And it was simply, who's the bitch in the red dress?
That just... Oh, but there is such overall a sense of creative ferment in this book, of artists and contemporaries making their marks in the world. And I'm sure that being part of this group spurred you on in your own work in many ways.
I guess it did. You know, hindsight is wonderful, and in retrospect, of course it did. In the moment, I was too busy feeling like, you know, my nose was pressed up against the window pane of watching them in their world and with their success.
And over the arc of your life in this book, it's not all sweetness and light. I mean, you were there in New York at the beginning in the height of the AIDS epidemic. And that is something you bear witness to in this book, which is so important.
Well, I think it is because I think, you know, sort of how quickly we forget. And too much forgetting makes us, among other things, stupid. But we need to not forget how that started, how inhumane people were to each other, how horrific it was to those who had and succumbed from the disease and to those who loved them. And that's a part of the story as well. I just recently was on a walking tour of my old neighborhood, going by Sam's old apartment, my old apartment, my old first apartment. And one of the things that we went by was St. Vincent's Hospital, which was certainly the epicenter for care during the AIDS epidemic in New York City. And it's been I almost want to say deconsecrated. It's no longer a hospital. It has become condos. And I remember saying to the individual, my goodness, I cannot imagine that there is any way to get all of the sadness out that those walls have absorbed. So I don't know that I'd be living in there as a condo.
All right. That's staggering. Really is.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is this. James Baldwin is having such a moment right now. He's being read and recognized and appreciated in a new way, I think. And that means one thing to those of us who know him through his work. But I imagine it means another thing to those who knew him personally. And I wonder if you'd say a few words about your experience of him and why you think he is having this moment of renaissance.
Well, I knew him personally. I certainly knew him. I don't want it to sound like I was his best friend.
Fair enough.
Sam was his best friend.
Right.
I was Sam's friend. And so I was at the party, but not necessarily at the head table all the time or ever. But what I can say is, and I've seen the recent film, I Am Not Your Negro.
Mm-hmm.
I think had I seen the film and had I known that aspect of Baldwin before I met him, I might have been even more awed and just unable to utter a coherent sentence. He is a towering intellect, was a towering intellect, still is a towering intellect. I remember coming out of the film thinking, oh my God, he's the Libyan Sybil. He really is, in the film, which is made up of clips, oracular about much that's going on today. And I think that's part of the reason is that what he said, his elegant manner of saying it, and his absolute humanity is what we need, what we desperately need right now.
Now more than ever, I think. Now, writing a memoir is such an act of reckoning with personal history, family life, friendship, professional growth and change. You know, Colette has that wonderful quote, "What a wonderful life I've lived. If only I'd recognized it sooner."
Church would like to say amen to Colette on that.
Yes. Did you have that sense of recognition, or did it come to you as you were writing this book? And why did you decide it was the right time to write this book?
I knew Maya Angelou over a period of about 40 years, and after she died, was called by someone who knew I'd known her and said, you know, did you ever cook with her? And I'm like, yeah, we cooked on a couple of occasions together. And they said, well, we'd like you to do an article for the New York Times. So I did, and it was published, and subsequently I was having dinner with my editor of High on the Hog about any number of things, and Catherine Belden said, well, so what are you thinking about for your next book? And it's like, I don't know, and we batted a couple of ideas around, and she liked some of them and didn't like some of them and thought some needed work. And then just as we were getting ready to have the coffee and the, you know, after-dinner drink, probably in my case, I said, oh, by the way, have you seen the article that I wrote about Dr. Angelou? And she said, no, what's it about? And I explained. And she said, okay, that's your next book. And that was kind of the genesis of it.
Now, this book is such a catalog of delights. I mean, those recipes. Of course, you could not write a memoir without recipes. But I have to say, my first plan is to make Tin Boy curry, because that intrigues me so. But then you thoughtfully provide this playlist at the back of the book. But I love that you've made it possible for us to recreate those moments with the food and the music. And you've really made this a book of sensual pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, music was and is so important to me. I tend to work in silence simply because I am so transformed by various musical things. I mean, it really does work on my mood.
Mm-hmm.
In any number of ways. So I work in silence because it allows me to concentrate, because if there's music, I'm involved with the music. So the tunes that I heard in my head are the tunes that are on the playlist, basically. I mean, and some of them are of the period. Some of them are things I would have listened to if I'd known about them in the period.
Right.
Some of them are things that are too apt for the mood, the chapter, the whatever, to not be included. So the playlist was an extraordinary amount of fun.
Well, this is a book that really invites the reader in. You know, you need to put something on the stove and get those good smells going and then put on the music and read the book. That would be the perfect day.
Thank you.
Oh, well, we've been talking with the great culinary historian Jessica Harris, whose new book is the wonderful memoir My Soul Looks Back. You can meet her Thursday, June 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been delightful.
Pick it loud and pick it sound. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Military historian Nicholas Reynolds has deployed his talents in many fields. As a Marine colonel, an Oxford-trained historian, collecting accounts from military officers in the field, a CIA officer, and the historian for the CIA Museum, a professor at Johns Hopkins, and a dog rescuer. It sounds like there are several books he could write in this lifetime. But today we're talking about his newest, Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures, 1935 to 1961. Nick Reynolds, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you describe so beautifully that moment that set you on the path to this book, that search through the archives that yielded the first lead. I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Initially, I was doing something else. I didn't set out to write this book. Didn't know if I had another book in me, despite your kind comments there. And I was double-checking my research on basically American intelligence in World War II, and the Hemingway family's contribution to that in particular. And I'd looked in all the likely places, and I decided to check a few less likely places to make sure I hadn't missed anything. And I pulled a book off the shelf called Spies, which is about Soviet espionage in the United States, mostly during the 1930s and to a certain extent during the 1940s. You know, the quick and easy way to check a book is just to look at the index. And I saw a robust Hemingway entry and went to that entry and read in this well-documented book that Ernest Hemingway had been recruited by the NKVD, which was Soviet intelligence, better known later as the KGB, to work with them against fascism. And that really threw me for a loop for a couple reasons. One was I've been a lifelong Hemingway fan, and Hemingway has always been the quintessentially American writer for me. And the other was I had worked at CIA, and kind of the worst thing you could do in my day at CIA was sign up to work with the Russians, or the Soviets in particular. And so I was pretty upset by this, and that's what started me down the path to writing this book.
It's amazing the things we find in libraries and books and papers and archives.
Libraries are dangerous places. Yeah.
But you begin this book with a scene that will resonate particularly with many local readers, and that's Hemingway touring the devastation after a Florida hurricane in 1935. And in particular, he was out in his boat touring the Florida coastline, and he was able to see the bodies of many American vets who were camped in Florida after World War One. Which added another layer, don't you think?
He's a World War One veteran himself.
Right.
And seeing that devastation, seeing veterans who could have been better served, I don't think there was a plot by the Roosevelt administration or gross negligence on their part, but they could have been better served. I'll agree with him there. And that moved him deeply in a way. I mean, he had an enormously exciting life, but every so often in his life you can identify an event or a series of events that particularly moved him, and a number of them crop up in his story. So that's the first one. And then in the Spanish Civil War, we can actually pinpoint the time when he went to the guerrilla camp where he gathered the experiences that drove the plot of For Whom the Bell Tolls. And then he has other significant experiences like the liberation of Paris in 1944, and then in Cuba, eventually, he starts to get involved in politics. And there's kind of a thread running through these. My argument is that there's a narrative arc that goes from 1935 to 1961 and connects these various events.
And this is a literary biography. You trace the impact of these experiences on his writing.
I do. I think the high point of my story and Hemingway's political activism, is For Whom the Bell Tolls. I mean, this is a magnificent novel of engagement. It's a call to arms, and it's also a compelling story. And then that puts him more or less on the skyline. So he's gone from 1935, where he doesn't really care about politics or say much about politics, and here he's saying, hey, you know, we need to rally to the anti-fascist colors. We need to fight these bad guys, the Nazis. We need to fight Hitler. We need to fight Mussolini. And then he has the relationship with the Soviets, who are on the same side, or appear to him to be on the same side. And then after World War II, he realizes that he has gone further to the left than he might have intended, while the political spectrum in the United States shifts to the right. So he spends a lot of the rest of his life looking over his shoulder and wondering if the FBI is going to come for him or there's going to be some other consequence. And my argument is that what you see him writing after the war is a lot less ambitious and going back to the less political writing that he did before 1935. So if For Whom the Bell Tolls is a call to arms, Across the River and Into the Trees could be summed up in two or three words, like I'm tired. And then there's The Old Man and the Sea, which is not particularly political in any way. And then there's books about bullfighting and kind of memoirs like Paris is a Movable Feast, which I still like a lot, by the way. I'm not saying it's bad literature. I'm just saying that the agenda shifts from For Whom the Bell Tolls and then to kind of things that are not going to get him in trouble politically.
So how do you feel about him now? If this journey of writing this book began with that gut punch to your perceptions of him, how do you feel about him now? Do you still read his books with the same pleasure?
That's a great question, and the answer is complicated. I still enjoy reading him as much as I ever did, and perhaps admire more books like For Whom the Bell Tolls, where even though he's very clearly on one side of the political equation there, he honestly portrays what he sees on the other side of the equation. So he doesn't demonize everybody that he opposes. His enemies are the nationalists, the people who support Franco, but he allows them to be human beings in For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he also shows the shortcomings of his own side. He doesn't say that everything the anti-fascist side did was wonderful. There's a famous scene in there in the village called, I believe, Rhonda, where the townspeople chase their nationalists over a cliff. And that's one of the great scenes of 20th century literature. So, still love the literature, still read it with pleasure. My feelings about his political judgment are, one way of looking at it is he's more human now than he was before. He's not as much of a charismatic figure, to me anyway, who does all these things and seems to do them so well.
We've been talking with Nicholas Reynolds, author of Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures, 1935 to 1961. You can meet him Monday, June 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Hemingway's whiskey, warm, smooth, and mean. Even when it burns, it'll always finish clean. Didn't like it watered down, he took it straight up and neat. If it was bad enough for him, you know it's bad enough for me. Hemingway's whiskey.
Phyllis Jordan does a lot of great things for our community, and today we're talking about one of her favorite projects, the Symphony Book Fair, which is back for year 64. It's coming up June 2nd through June 4th at the Lakefront Arena. Phyllis Jordan, it's so great to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Now, this is the big event coming up this weekend, but the work of the Symphony Book Fair goes on all year, doesn't it?
It does. We have an amazing cadre of volunteers who come in 2 days a week and work in a warehouse that defies description and sorts books, prices them, sorts for condition, but also for current value, so that a book about medicine or law or science, something that would have a lot of changes in it, is a current book in that area.
Of course. Now, how many volunteers do you have altogether, you think?
I believe we have about 13 who work during the whole year, and they are just magnificent. In fact, that's why it's a 64-year-old institution, is that there are these volunteers who put in a lot of time and energy, as well as people continuing to bring us books all the time.
Right. Now, I've been to that warehouse on Oak Street, and it's as close to heaven as it gets
for booksellers.
Oh, yeah.
Well, closer
book lovers,
is
rather.
The book fair itself, because people walk into the basketball arena at UNO, Lakeside Arena. It's covered with books.
So tell us about some of the more unusual things you have this year.
We have some amazing things. We have a collection of history and culture and sociology of Argentina and Chile. One of the professors in the area, I think, was retiring and sent us his books. A very fine collection. But I have just a few oddball things that might be interesting to people. So
I know you pulled out some great things from your book bag. All right, tell us about
these. So I have this book by Winston Churchill, which is a biography of Richard Carvel. Winston wrote it like in the 1899. It's remarkable.
And it has that beautiful binding,
and the gilt edge.
And there are a lot of Churchill fanatics out there.
Oh, and we have a lot of books on Churchill this year. For some reason, we got a lot on Churchill. So we have a lot of things that are in this category, which would be like collectors, things that people might have a particular interest in, and books that have a certain amount of value to them.
And you have a lot of books for New Orleanians.
Yes, we do.
And New Orleanians love books about themselves and their city.
Don't we, though? I have this treasure here, the 1985 book for the Boston Club, which includes a history and a list of all the presidents and past officers. And it's 1985, just a little photograph of time in New Orleans. That was really fun. And also we have a cookbook called The Gravy, which is recipes by New Orleans musicians and little stories about them.
And then you have some other rare things. You have two other cookbooks here.
Yes.
One I know well.
Right. Well, the one that you probably don't know well is called Spies, Black Ties, and Mango Pies. Stories and recipes from the CIA families all over the world. I don't know what secrets are in here, but there's a moussaka recipe right here and other interesting things. I thought this was very curious.
Yes.
And then I think the other one that you know well is Nellie Custis Lewis's housekeeping book, which was edited by Patricia Brady Smith. And it has been reprinted by the New Orleans Historic Collection.
And I have made that gingerbread recipe, and it is a good one. So
that's
I can
great.
Vouch for that.
That's great. So, you know, we have probably 75,000 titles that we are putting out. We sort things very carefully by topic. So we have a military history section, a biography section, travel, science and nature, and then, of course, a very large fiction section with sci-fi and mystery and romance sectioned off. And then the regular fiction it's not quite alphabetized, but it is in four sections of the alphabet. So if you're looking for somebody in particular, you can find it.
And you have lots of rare books this year,
yes,
too.
Yes, we do. We have a first edition Confederacy of Dunces.
That's a prize.
Yeah.
Oh, and you have some signed Kurt Vonnegut's.
We have a signed Kurt Vonnegut. It's the 25th anniversary of Slaughterhouse-Five. So we have real treasures.
And I love that you have a first edition of Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Yes,
you
right.
know, that's a treasure.
Right.
And that's not all you have. You have art, you have music.
Yes, we have lots of sheet music, lots of instructional books on teaching music. We also have lots of DVDs. We're doing vinyl now, which is very popular again. And DVDs, the movies and things. And the art selection is just wonderful.
So what do you all do with the leftover books?
Well, this year we have an arrangement with a group called Thrift Books, an online bookseller.
Ah.
So books that don't sell at the book sale, we'll go to them and they will put them online and share the proceeds with us. So we have hopefully another way of making more money for the orchestra to a different audience. So if you see it at book fair, you better get it because it's going to be gone.
Well, that's the thing. At events like this, you see books you never see anywhere else.
Absolutely.
And we'll never see again,
yes,
probably.
Right.
Some
that's
of
right.
them.
Yeah.
And how much money do you generally make for the symphony? Does it stay the same?
It has changed a lot over the years. And with Katrina, there was a real dip.
Yeah.
Starting to come back up again now. And then we hold back some money for expenses and so forth. The LPO volunteers, the Symphony Volunteers Group, gives about $125,000 a year to the orchestra, and we're
fantastic.
A big part of that.
See, I love that. It's like the underground economy.
Yes,
of
exactly.
Going back into
exactly.
the community.
And then, of course, they donate them back to us, too, because we often open books and find our pricing on
nice.
The inside.
Saves a little
That's right.
next time.
That's right.
Oh, we've been talking with Phyllis Jordan, who'll be on hand for the Symphony Book Fair. It opens up Friday, June 2nd, and runs through June 4th at the University of New Orleans Gardens, Lakefront Arena on Franklin Avenue. Hours are Friday from 9 to 8. There's an admission charge from 9 to 3, free after 3. It's open Saturday from 9 to 8, Sunday from 9 to 4. Phyllis, thanks so much for all you do.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans is sponsoring a book circle facilitated by Freddie Evans discussing the sassy book women of New Orleans. That's Tuesday, May 30th at 6 at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, 1205 North Rampart. Free, but RSVP to WNBAofNOLA@gmail.com. New members, welcome. The Keller Library presents Chekhov at the Library, scenes from Chekhov's plays, featuring performances by Amanda Wursten and Andre Boren on the library's back deck, Wednesday, May 31st from 6 to 7 at the Keller Library. Today's guest, Jessica Harris, reads from and signs My Soul Looks Back, a memoir, Thursday, June 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Paige Bauer signs The General's Niece, the little-known de Gaulle who fought to free occupied France, Thursday, June 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. The 2017 Symphony Book Fair begins Friday, June 2nd and runs Sunday, June 4th at the UNO Lakefront Arena. Hours are Friday from 9 to 8. There's an admission charge from 9 to 3, free after 3, Saturday from 9 to 8 and Sunday from 9 to 4. Also coming up, it's time to start thinking about summer reading for young readers in our area. The annual East Baton Rouge Parish Library summer reading programs begin Tuesday, May 30th. All locations of the library will have reading logs for each age group, children, teens, and adults. These logs will be available till the end of July. Check out ebrpl.com for schedules and information. Every branch library in the New Orleans Public Library System holds a kickoff event June 3rd for summer reading. Check your branch library schedule or neworleanspubliclibrary.org for the complete schedule of events and summer reading groups. Library Palooza, the grand kickoff for the 2017 Jefferson Parish Summer Reading Program, happens from 10 a.m. to 12:30 on Saturday, June 3rd. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And from 10 to 2 Saturday, June 3rd at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Sherry Collins signs Arise and Call Her Blessed, A Daughter's Memoir, Sunday, June 4th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Pirate Sally Faulkner Society hosts their annual Juleps in June celebration, June 4th at 6, featuring Joyce Blaylock, author of Adelicia, and Randy Denman, author of Off the Grid, My Ride from Louisiana to the Panama Canal in an Electric Car. For ticket information, email Faulkhouse, F-A-U-L-K House, at AOL.com. Today's guest, Nicholas Reynolds, signs Writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures, 1935 to 1961, Monday, June 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. And Bloomsbury Publishing's Boldly Bookish YA Author Tour comes to New Orleans Tuesday, June 6th. You can meet Tara Aldobrando, author of The Possible, Sarah Tolser, author of Song of the Current, Emery Lord, author of The Names They Gave Us, and Bridget Kemmerer, author of Letters to the Lost. That's Tuesday, June 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.